accurately in the generalizations that have been given to us by three poets. In spite of the fact that Hippocrates says, if for the sake of a crowded audience you do wish to hold a lecture, your ambition is no laudable one, and at least avoid all citations from poets, for to quote them argues feeble industry. I'm going to give you a demonstration of my feeble industry by attempting to summarize, as I have suggested, the three points of view presented this afternoon in the words of various poets. It seemed to me that Mr. Plutzik conceives of the poet as being something of a prestidigitator, an intellectual prestidigitator. Form is the cage and sense the bird. The poet twirls them in his mind and wins the trick with both combined. Sense caught within the cage, finally. It seems to me that Mr. Snodgrass's point of view might be summarized in the words of Sidney. Said my muse to me, look into thy heart and write. And finally, I think Mr. Garland's point of view may perhaps have been a refutation of Virgil's precept. Do not commit your poems to pages alone. Sing them, I pray you. If we are to continue the discussion, then I would like to start the evening's procedure by still another quotation. Macaulay, that eminent Victorian gentleman, said of poetry, perhaps no person can be a poet or can even enjoy poetry without a certain unsoundness of mind. I would like to toss that to our three poets tonight. This is an issue, an accusation that frequently comes up. Are poets like other people? If they're not, what makes them different? Well, suppose we start off with you, Chaim. What do you think about this? Is the poet different? If so, how?
Well, this comes under the heading of a leading question, and of course I've got to be very careful as to how I reply to this, because no doubt applications can immediately be made. I frankly think that poets are people. I agree with Mr. Gollin that there are a large number of people writing poetry, and I've always felt that the fact that our politicians do not take into consideration the poet vote in our country shows a lack of realism on their part. People will write poems and, yes, put them in the drawer, but there are quite a number of poets around. But in all seriousness, coming back to your original remark, Bill, I think you used the word unsound, was that it?
Macaulay used the word unsound.
Yeah. I don't want to be personal, but I think some of his poetry is unsound, though quite rational. We can twist that a little bit by shifting the word unsound over into the word irrational, that the poet does probe into what is sometimes called the irrational. The universe to the poet, I think, is not one that is finally explicable in direct expository language. The poet usually feels that an expository statement gives us only a partial picture of reality, gives us a faulty picture of reality. So if we use the word unsound in the sense of a probing into the irrational, I would agree with that. I think, however, that the idea that poets are impractical, or the sort of people that bump into trees and so on, is a misconception based on certain behavior patterns of the romantic poets, and very often the behavior patterns of pseudo-romantic poets or post-romantic poets, who are following what they think are the conventions of poetry. If you go back far enough in the history of poetry, you'll find poets who are quite practical. Chaucer was a public administrator, as I recall. Shakespeare was quite a businessman, and so on. I don't think we have to associate the writing of poetry with what is called unsoundness or an impracticality. As I say, I think this is a misconception based on a misconception of the nature of the Romantic poet. And this is one of the things that has alienated the poet from society. The poet then becomes an outsider when essentially perhaps he shouldn't be an outsider at all.
It seems to me that the poet isn't being willfully an outsider. It seems to me that in order to write, he has to look at things that most people prefer not to look at. In Chaucer's time, it was a little easier to look at these things without being thrown out, thrown downstairs. The social standards weren't so high. People were perhaps, I think, a little more willing to see a wider view of themselves. The reason that the poet probably seems unsound to Macaulay, though, is that he insists upon seeing as much of himself as he can. It seems to me that in this way he's very much different from most people. I don't think that this is necessarily unsound. I think most people suffer a great deal from the fact that they don't see this much of themselves. Some of my favorite people are waitresses who write poems. And in several towns, I've had a waitress of this sort, where I would go into a restaurant late at night, and I would be sitting around having a cup of coffee and take out a pad and start scribbling, and a waitress would come over and say, would get interested and watch what I was doing, and then pretty soon she'd come back with her purse and would say, "You're writing poems, aren't you?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And she'd say, "Well, I wrote a couple of poems once," and then she takes out her wallet and she says, I had a little boy who died, and this is a poem that I wrote, and it was published in the paper. Would you read it?" And I get very fond of such people. I'm always very grateful for them doing this. But the poems, of course, are always very, very bad. And I think the reason that they're bad is that into these poems they have poured all kinds of softnesses and tendernesses and things which they have ruled out of their lives, which they haven't dared to take a look at. I mean, this is one way in which these people, I mean, women, like these waitresses, have aren't really writing about themselves, aren't really seeing what they are.
Well, what you say here, then, is a substantiation, is it not, of the fact that there are a lot of poets around. Now, they may not good poets, but here was another member of the large poet vote we have in this country, that is these waitresses. General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, speeches, I think it was in his second campaign, made a remark like this: "This country needs its artisans, its carpenters, its so and so and so on." So he mentioned about four or five categories of occupation, and then he said, "Even its poets." Here at last, we have recognition, but the fact that there are a number of waitresses around who write poetry, I think, indicates that Ike was on the right track if he kept up with it.
I'd like to break in and wonder at two other possible senses of the word soundness, unsound, rather. If by that Macaulay means diseased, I doubt that a diseased mind in that sense can write a poem. A poem has to be shaped. It needs a formal order. If he means unstable, then I would second the motion and include waitresses and the great unsung, though singing, writers of poems for bureau drawers. People who find the that light keeps them slightly off balance, as it should if they are feeling its blows at all, or for that matter, its nudges and tickles, and attempt to resolve in their own minds on paper, using, as I said, the poem's cry for unity as the device whereby they compose their own lives. I think poets, in this sense, are the most sane of people, if you two gentlemen will pardon this, in that they recognize and attempt to cope with their instability. They must, consciously.
What Macaulay's overlooking is the fact that mankind has been unsound ever since the days of one certain Adam who ate an apple.
Well, now, this harkens back to something that John Ciardi said in the recent conference. That is that most of the actions of one's life are irrational actions, and God help the man who tries to select a wife or to die in a rational manner. Is this true? Must the poem necessarily deal with this idea of the imbalance? Must the poem be about something which is not, say, within the common run of experience? Is a poem always going to be an attempt, as Dick has just suggested, to sustain or to maintain a balance which inevitably will be dismissed, will be thrown off by the actions of life? Is it true that the actions about which we write poetry are the so-called irrational actions?
Well, it seems to me that we might be talking about two things here. If the poem is a successful poem, and the same could be said about any work of art, then it's got to be a coherent statement. A coherent statement, if necessary, about incoherence. If the problem of the poet is the incoherence of the universe or the incoherence of his own self, in the poem, he has to make this incoherent subject some sort of artistic form. So a successful poem can't be unsound. I think of Lionel Trilling's remark concerning the writer and neurosis, the idea often expressed that your great writer or great poet, or even lesser writer or lesser poet, is a neurotic, unsound then, if you will, or irrational. Trilling points out that by virtue of his success as an artist, this poet controls or overcomes his neurosis. In other words, the neurosis is not the cause of his poetry, but maybe something that he suffers from or would suffer from whether he were a poet or not. In other words, Trilling says, there are many neurotics in the world, and the neurotic who doesn't control or overcome his neurosis is not the poet. The poet is not a poet because of neurosis, in spite of it, if you will. So that his art is a way of overcoming the unsoundness, if you will, the incoherence, if you will, of a universe which is not explicable in direct expository terms. A straight expository sentence tends ultimately to be abstract and does not give sufficient recognition to the mystery of things and the mystery of the human personality. So that if the poet is irrational, I think it's not because he negates reason, it's because his poetry has to go beyond reason.
My own experience, Hiram, is that going among groups of artists and people who are sort of hangers-on of artists, but generally speaking, the people who are really producing work are people who are really too busy to be courting their neurosis. But generally speaking, it's the people who are sort of hangers-on and who suspect that their own work isn't very good, who then deliberately court neurosis as a kind of substitute and flaunt any inabilities that they may have, insecurities and perversions and whatnot, deliberately flaunt these by way of trying to suggest to people who don't know that they are artists, playing up to the popular misconception.
I've just received a question from someone in the audience. We'll have verbal questions later on. This one is written. The question is, isn't there anything but subjective lyric poetry? You've been suggesting always the intimacy, the subjectivity of experience. Can there be lyric poetry which is not subjective?
Well, we're breaking down categories. I'll remain true to my stand earlier and declare that none of this is subjective. All are the creation of objectified dramatic acts.
And I'll chime in by saying that all of it is subjective.
My point, which is that it's a false distinction. To talk about something as objective as opposed to subjective is not sensible talk. That you don't know what yourself is, what the subject is, except how it's operated on by microphones and people and so forth. You don't define the self and the object. All you define is an interaction.
Would either of you insensible gentlemen care to answer that?
Well, the reason I say that it's all subjective goes back to my remark about, well, could tie in with the difference between I think the point of view of the poet and the scientist. Now, in many respects, this point of view has similarities. They're trying to understand the nature of the world. But the physical science attempts the farthest extreme of objectivity. As the scientist, as observer, has to submerge himself as much as he can, insofar as he allows his own personal reactions to color his description of the experiment or his description of the observed data. He is going contrary to the laws of science. On the other hand, I feel that poetry tries to get at the value or at the quality of an experience. And that quality, no matter how detached the poet is, or how unromantic he is, that quality can be expressed only through his subjectivity. And by subjectivity, I don't mean his idiosyncrasy. He may be subjective, but if he's writing a good poem, then his subjectivity has a universality about it, which makes his experience something that can be shared when it's understood by his reader, by other people.
Well, you've raised the distinction between literature and science. I've always thought the chief distinction, not so much the placement of what the objects under examination are, so much as that the scientist rigorously attempts to exclude from his analysis, this includes the social sciences, all considerations of value. Whereas the writer necessarily is concerned with human actions, human feelings, and so human values. Finally, this may turn into an argument as to where the sources of value are. If within an individual's reaction to some event, or including an event he has just scribbled down, then we are proclaiming that the world is the gray, barren whiteness that Melville wrote of, and the writer is investing it with color.
Well, that presupposes that he is reading something, is that what you're saying? Reading something into the his image of the world, reading something into nature, just as sometimes we professors of literature are accused of reading something into a poem or a novel or whatever it is. I wonder whether that's a justifiable remark. Not that he's reading something into nature, it's that he feels that a true revelation of reality must involve not so much a dispassionate description in expository language of reality, but it must involve a communication of the quality of experience that the artist has, that is a prior reality, actually, or that without this quality of experience, you've got a very incomplete picture. I think an analogy could be made between a poem and the summary of a poem. To me, the summary of the poem, the expository statement, is pure data. Whereas the poem itself goes beyond the data or uses the data for purposes of communicating the quality of an experience. Now, if the experience may be the poet's own experience, or in the case of a dramatic poem or a dramatic monologue, whatever it may happen to be, it will not only be the poet's experience, but the experience of the character whom he builds up in the poem.
And you declare that the poem you spoke of this afternoon was not a subjective lyric at all, but a brief dramatic poem.
Well, I think it's a subjective lyric. I give my interpretation of a certain type of human being, and I go beyond the autobiographical into a revelation of the quality of the experience of that human being, and that is, I think, a form of subjectivity.
The subjective experience objectively described.
Well, perhaps so.
This is the point where most people who listen to Coleridge orating on poetry usually fell asleep.
Coleridge was a brilliant man, but his sentences were likely sometimes to be awfully elaborate, and perhaps it was this complexity or his insistence on imposing upon poetry certain metaphysical criteria or bringing to bear his desire to be a metaphysician that may have put them to sleep.
Well, I'd like to ask a question of both of you gentlemen, which might indirectly lead back into this question, and that is, both describe your poems as emanating out of self, and I suppose there is no experience of the universe which does not, yet you publish. Why that particular act? Does the poem fail to reach some kind of finality until read by someone other than yourself? In short, is it a communication?
You know what I threatened you? And if you asked me this question, I was going to say it was because I wanted a promotion. For some such reason, certainly, that for some such reason, I suppose, is why I conceive it as being something like why a bird sings. I mean, you say, look, I'm working this side of the street. This is me, still here. If you come around here, you have to deal with me. This is who it is. I feel that I have somehow asserted my values, have represented them in the world, and having done that, feel better. I don't worry very much about whether they get published or not, except for such entirely secondary reasons as that. I do worry about whether my friends like them or not.
Well, I think that I don't worry terribly whether they get published or not. And I must confess that when I get a rejection slip, I'm not exactly happy. I think that under contemporary circumstances, publication is in one way part of the creative act. Now that may be just my personal reaction. That is that a poem is not completed until it is published. Now in earlier eras, publishing might have been something else. That publishing might have been, before the days of printing, was circulating the poem among your friends and the lovers of literature in manuscript. In our time, getting the poem published is, I think, the necessary and the final commitment. As one of the things in manuscript, I find, for instance, that I have a tendency to tinker with it. There's a law of diminishing returns in tinkering. Perhaps it's just my insecurity in that respect. I think getting it published is the necessary commitment. One can still revise the poem after having it published, but one has made the commitment, one can go on to the next thing. Otherwise, the poem remains incomplete. So I think that publishing is really very important, but there the poet comes up against the fact that he may be saying something quite valid, but he may be ahead of his age, or he may be writing in an idiom which is not popular in his time, and those posterity may recognize him, but his contemporaries may not, and that will be a misfortune. But I do think that publication is an important part of the total creative process. Now, I when I can, get somebody who is convinced, I hope, try to get my things published. Because, again, I don't think that poetry is merely self-expression. That's what Harry Levin called expressivism. As why does one write a poem? To express oneself? It's one way of looking at it. And if you really write only to express yourself, I think then you shouldn't ask for a publication. But if you write for two purposes, one, to express yourself, and secondly, to communicate, then publication is part of the communication. Do I grate on someone's sensibilities here, or?
Well, I'm a little bothered. This idea of communicating, now, I've been worried ever since the first conference was held in March with Mr. Keenbush saying, why should I ping for you? You may have a low IQ. If one is going to communicate, then presumably this involves writer, medium, and communique. That person, or communique, I suppose it would be, the person to whom this is communicated. Does this not mean that inevitably the tool or the instrument of your communication must be comprehensible to the person to whom or for whom you are writing? Do you write with a specific audience in mind? Will you scale down a poem? Will you perhaps temper the wind of the shorn lamb and the choice of words you use? The truth of your insight may be a truth that you perceive, but will you phrase this in such a way that another person who might not get this will have something of the same insight? To what extent does this idea of communicating writing for an audience determine your method of expression, if you will, or the nature of your insight?
Very little, I think. I find that I write mainly for one or two friends who I rather assume to be good readers, very good readers, I think. And if they can convince me that I've not said something adequately, I usually go back and work it over. But this is only one or two very special people, and I don't always listen to them. Maybe I ought to more often. I do feel, though, that they are excellent readers, and that generally speaking, when they say something is wrong, it means that there's something wrong with the thinking, essentially.
Well, that wouldn't that have to do with the actual construction of the poem? But isn't that making something private out of the poem, let's say, the right for a few people whose judgment concerning the techniques, poetry, and so on you admire?
Mm-hmm.
In the larger sense, shouldn't one feel that if his poetry involves just a limited and private communication, that he hasn't made adequate use of the resources of the English language, and the English language is a public thing. I don't see how one can say one writes for oneself, for instance, when one uses a public method of communication. One writes for, well, an ideal reader, that's been said, or one writes for, since one can never be completely sure of the success of one's work, though there are times one has to be stubborn in spite of one's friends, doesn't one write or feel justified at the end when his poem wins the respect of people whose taste he respects?
All right, but that's a very small number of people, and the English language is used as a public language is a very poor medium. And essentially, very poor medium. What you hear on the radio, what is available to the mass, the language that is available to the mass of the people, who, as Geronimo said, not only don't read it. I mean, they don't read one book a year. Not even Peter Rabbit. That's too hard. I don't believe that that you can hold your insight down.
Oh, no,
to the level of that. And I think if you're using If you're writing for the public in that sense, for the general public, or even for the general educated public, you're going to be committed to a public language which will not permit you to say what you really know.
Well, I'm not. There are different public languages. There is the public language of radio and TV and so on. But I think you cannot really speak of a private language. If it's a language at all, it's a public language.
No, it's a public language.
It is not a private language. It is one of the public languages.
No.
Well, a man raised in isolation will not have language. Language is a product of interaction among men. But there are many degrees and levels of public. There is the society you form with a loved one, the society you form talking to an audience of 1,000 or over the radio, each calls forth different words, and these words necessarily have not only their communicable content, but the private associations, which are a product of perhaps your public past, but now invisible to anyone else. I don't think you can avoid using language in a partially private manner, at least.
Exactly what you go to a poem for, I think, is to find a new person in the poem, a new speaker. And you go to a new poet because he has a new voice, a voice that's different from any voice that you've heard before, and that voice symbolizes a different person. And I think it's inevitable that you're only going to be able to communicate at first to a very few people. Simone Weil said, it's necessary that young writers or somebody who has something to say intellectually will at first only be recognized by people who like them personally. That if you have something new to say, or if you have someone new to be, this is so threatening to other people that they can only stand this if they love you first.
Well, I'm not claiming that the poet should trail sails to the wind of popularity. In other words, that he should break down his standards in order to appeal to a a wider public. But on the other hand, I do think he should always ask himself whether in his excitement at, or in his, in the thrill that he gets out of expression, he hasn't lost contact with what has traditionally been a quality of poetry or any art, that is communication. He always has to ask himself whether in adherence to his standards he hasn't yielded to some private caprice. It's an equilibrium.
Before we get into too much balance here on this business of interaction among men, I think undoubtedly there are a good many people who would like to ask you questions at this point. So suppose we throw the meeting over for everybody, and if there are questions, Judy? The question is, do these poets write for men who are like the poets themselves, men who would have the same values, the same ideas?
My answer can be brief. I write to find out, since part of me constitutes the audience for the other part I was writing.
I write under the assumption that I'm writing for people who are different. If they were the same, there'd be no point in writing. There would be nothing to say to them.
Well, you said that, was it that the poet expresses his difference from other people? Is that it?
That's one of the things that he expresses.
Now, couldn't you reverse that? Couldn't you reverse that and say that the poetry will not be of the highest value unless, in this difference, the reader discovers a universal element that makes this poem apply to all men? So I wonder whether the poet then is revealing his difference in thought or opinion, or whether he's revealing his difference in technique, in his originality of observation. But that these differences are really ultimately subservient to his similarity with the other human beings who constitute his reading public. Now, I don't think I write for people who agree with me philosophically or politically or religiously or anything like that. And nor do I necessarily read or like poems with whose authors I agree. I read the poetry of Robinson Jeffers, and I disagree with him on a number of points, but I think that his is a powerful statement of that point of view. I think, however, that I probably do write for the reader, or at least that the reader of my poetry, though he may not agree with my opinions, must have something of the same type of sensibility about the nature of things, because otherwise my discoveries, such as they are, would not seem significant to him.
Steve? I would like to hear some commentary, further commentary, upon this idea that the poet actually is putting himself down on the page. And I wonder if there isn't really a misrepresentation of the function of poetry and perhaps art expressed here. It seems to me that if there's any value which inheres in art, it has very little to do with the poet, and to concentrate upon the poet's personal let's say expiation of sin, of his own personal sin. Well, this may be well and good, and this may be a reason why he writes poetry, but it seems to me that there's perhaps a poem is something more like a commitment, which Mr. Plutzik was talking about, and the commitment comes about through the audience reaction to the poem. I mean, if there were no audiences, And if there were no utilitarian uses for poetry, there would be no poetry, and the artists would have to, well, just pack up and go home. And I think it seems to me we've been talking so much about the artist and the poem that we haven't been talking at all about what the poem does and what the poem means in terms of, well, we can even use such words as truth. What is the truth of poetry? Is it in the artist, or is it in the other side of the balance, in some sense the interaction between the poem and the audience, and what this means in terms of the human condition?
I'm not even going to attempt to phrase that question.
Okay, I usually find myself in two positions simultaneously when writing. I'm exempt from one part of your question, in that even my wife finds my poems usually only when they've clogged the vacuum cleaner. But to say that when I write, I suppose I consider myself my own best audience. What I have put down is a kind of truth, not necessarily to me, because on the one hand, I read poetry in and for itself, hoping at least that the poem will make its own coherent statement, whether I know that the artist was a quiet businessman who died of old age or a wild drunkard who died at the age of 18. The poem itself, as I read it, coming into my mind, shaping my own experiences, is what is wherein the truth lies. And as far as it chimes for me, it finds resonant echoes, I'll declare it truth, be it subjective. This is the way I read my own poems in process.
Then it doesn't make any difference whether you read the poem or whether a poet three centuries ago read the poem. You're reading it as a poem, and in some sense the value is between you and the poem, as you as audience and the poem, somehow making you a better man.
Yeah, and I have the unique joy, which I cannot do with any other poems, of if I don't like what I read, I lay violent hands on it.
Bill? See, this afternoon you used a word that I want to raise here, sincerity. Now I can see where sincerity fitted very well in what you were talking about this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wondered how far you would extend this word in poetry, to what kinds of poetry, really how far you would carry it as a criterion. For example, to take it in relation to a dramatic poem, for example. Would you apply the same term, and if so, what would you mean by it?
Yes, I think I would. Looking at the poem, I would, or at the drama, I would be asking myself whether I thought the writer had been sincere with his own feelings. I mean, it seems to me, for instance, that Tennessee Williams is an extremely insincere writer, that he is saying things that he does not believe, and pretending to feel things that he does not feel. And I think, I mean, I wouldn't hesitate, I think, to point to things and say, this, I think, is an evidence of insincerity on his part as a mind.
Exactly.
Aren't you talking about artistic integrity here?
Yes, you could use the same word.
I can see if you demand sincerity in a lyric, this is one thing. But you demand it in a dramatic form, it's something else, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
artistic integrity.
I take the word integrity, except in so much as the word integrity tends to mean singleness. Whereas, I mean, actually, the whole thing, the mind may be a matter not of singleness, but of, you know, of great complication and splits and tensions pulling in half a dozen different directions. But, I would take the word integrity in place of sincerity.
Well, the problem is that, I mean, a poet can be very sincere and a very bad poet, right?
Oh, yes. wait a minute. No. He can be sincere he can be sincere as a rent payer or as a voter or so forth, and still be a very insincere writer. Well, generally, I mean, I think it's possible, but generally speaking, I haven't found it to be so.
Well, can't you have...
Pardon? What about Green, God help us?
I know nothing about his life. Generally speaking, though, the poets who I have thought were good poets were also fairly sincere people.
I wonder whether I think I disagree with your
least integrity, or they had great integrity as a personality and a considerable grasp of what they felt.
Well,
they didn't tend to kid themselves about who they were.
Cover too much territory.
Isn't it a moral or an ethical term rather than one to be applied to some aesthetic document? It seems to me that you can have a as I would disagree with you about this point. I think you can have a poem that is sincere, as we just mentioned, now, it's a very bad poem. I think, for instance, that Joyce Kilmer, or let's move away from Mr. Kilmer, since lots of people like trees and I don't want to disillusion them. Let's move on to Eddie West. Now, I think Eddie West is just as sincere as all get out. The trouble with him is that he sees a world, it's his world, in terms of cliches and sentimentalities.
That's insane.
A person who sees the world in those terms and expresses that world, I think is being sincere. As a matter of fact, I would want to raise the opposing point of view, though I hate to use the word sincere in connection with poetry, and say that I think a poet can be insincere and be a good poet in the sense of the word sincere as you use it.
Give me an example.
Yeats. Well, I think Yeats would be a good...
I can't think of a man who committed himself and his values more honestly and took more chances doing it than Yeats.
Do you think he sincerely and honestly believed in this sort of hodgepodge, hobgoblin, gobbledygook business that he worked on as sort of basis for his poetry?
Unfortunately, he did.
Well, he wasn't completely
sure. He gave
sure.
a kind of a commitment to it. And he certainly believed the things that he was saying in Sailing to Byzantium or any of those poems. You could take a better example, maybe in Rambeau, who set out deliberately to lose himself, to derange his senses, to lose the self that he was by writing. But I think his whole success is in the fact that he utterly failed. he tried to escape being a middle-class son dominated by this terrible oppressive mother and tried to escape this in his writing to hide it as far as he could, and it shines through and it's this that makes him a success.
Exactly what is shining through? When I look at a poem, I see the surface of a page and words, and I wonder exactly what you can point to and proclaim insincere. One can say, I think, a poem is insincere, but that turns out to be a poor critical term because it doesn't lead anywhere. It leads you behind the poem into your own hypothetical assumptions about the personality of the poet. You can, on the other hand, say a poem is superficial, that its images or its statements don't cohere. I declare Eddie Guest incoherent because when... it takes a heap of living to make a house a home. I don't know what he means. I don't know what the poem means. I don't know what that statement says about anything, even distantly approximating my experience.
I still don't see how the word superficial differs greatly from the word insincere.
Mr. Watts is from...
Are you really stuck with the word sincerity?
No.
Would you rather trade it for another word?
Well, I could.
Offer up.
I don't see why I should.
My own feeling would be that it has so many wrong connotations for your purpose.
It has many wrong connotations. But at the same time, it seems to me that for a man to write or do any kind of artistic creative work successfully, he's going to have what I can only call sincerity. I mean, meaning a willingness to look at all facets of his own personality or of the world as he sees it, which is the same thing, I think. And this takes a certain kind of, I don't know what else to call it.
That would imply that anybody who
intends to write
honestly.
Oh, no. Many people are not able to do that.
Well, now...
I think to imply that anybody who wants to write honestly is by definition capable of writing fine poetry.
No, many people are incapable of looking at themselves honestly.
Or seem to be. But let's grant
him that
this person who wants to be honest is capable of being honest.
Uh-huh. Then do I think I could write good poetry?
No.
Yes.
No.
Well, thank you for coming to Miss Adams.
Something attacked me that Al's being serious. Thomas was the song of the shirt. See, it's sincere. It's burdened and creaking with sincerity. It was awful.
Miss Cola.
I would like to know what you were going to say about something like your daughter's toilet and potato. How would you talk about the question of success or failure and culture in relation to rape and lust? What would you have to say about Paradise Lost? Do you think these are great subjective expressions of...
I think these are the expressions of great minds, and I think great minds are inherently honest with themselves. I think that when Paradise Lost is a bad poem, as I think it sometimes is, it is because of a kind of insincerity in the writer. I think Chaucer is one of the most sincere, and a person who's willing to take great gambles on what he's saying. Because he thinks it's so. For instance, to commit himself to the character of Pandarus, as he does there.
I'd like to know if Mr. Hinman thinks about this.
He thinks I'm wrong.
Bob? I do think you're wrong. I would ask you whether you would extend such a view to saying that a man who writes a love poem has got to be in love in terms of the poem which he is writing.
Oh, no.
Isn't what you're really saying is simply that he has to have thought honestly about the experience? It doesn't have to be his experience.
Oh, yes, yes.
You wouldn't insist that Chaucer be the stumble bum that he often represents himself as?
No,
well,
certainly
then
not.
I wouldn't use the term sincerity.
Okay.
Well, the thing that bothers me about the word sincerity is the fact that I think different poets find different reasons for the writing of poetry. Some poets will be sincere in the sense that they are impelled to write a poem in order to express a feeling that they have, whereas some people are impelled to write a poem expressing not so much the situation as it is, but something perhaps that they're afraid, as poets will either write about themselves, or they may write about what they're afraid of being, or they may write about what they would like to be, and they may express their fears, they may express their desires, and so on. So the person who appears in the poem may not have a very close similarity to the poet as we know him from biographical sources. Now, I don't think that's insincerity, because coming back again to it, it seems to me it's an ethical and moral term. We're dealing here with a matter of aesthetic success. Now, T's poem, The First Draft, I don't think that was insincere at all. I don't think it was as successful as your last draft. It wasn't insincere, it wasn't as complete in its handling of
it
the...
It told a lie. It told a direct lie about the nature of my feelings.
This is what I feel properly brought.
Yes.
Well, maybe I misinterpreted Mr. Snodgrass's remark about being different to the audience. Does this mean that before he writes, a poet, potential poet, must feel that he has something different to say? And if so, how can a young poet ever be sure of this?
There's a good one for you.
Is that one for me?
Anybody.
I'll say, look into your heart and without trying to be too horrified at what you see there, try to make sense of something of it. Inevitably, because we are unique individuals, in fact, though not always in our own mental image of ourselves, the closer you get to what you may find there, you must necessarily, that is, the closer you get with the language, the more individual and unique necessarily that language is going to spill out or spell out a feeling, a sense of a personality behind the feeling, whether it be that individual finally summed up or some hypothetical speaker.
There was another hand over here. Yes.
I was wondering about that insincerity. I'm wondering if it's perhaps not, I wouldn't say lack of insight, but a lack of polished sensitivity toward a particular idea which you have. You look at something and you feel it, but has your intelligence sharpened it to the point where it's clear and defined that you're able to set it down in words?
I don't think it's there until it's set down in words. It is still in that area of apprehension and intimation, shifting out of mind before you can turn your eyes closer to it. The question of catching the right words is involved.
I think that Mr. Snodgrass in his poem was in some ways trying to do what I was trying to do in mine, that is to discover inside of himself just what it was he was trying to do. I don't think the process of this discovery involves sincerity at all. It's the process of more a sharpening of one's instruments of research. However, I want to, if I may, just move away from that point to something that Mr. Kingbush...
I only found that I myself became able to write when I had been willing to take a long, hard look at everything that I didn't like about myself.
And
talk about it openly. I mean, and this means, I mean, if you like, if you want to call this, I mean, I can't think of a better word for it than being sincere, maybe being honest, but being willing to take a look at all the angles of yourself that you wish weren't there, and being willing to say that they are. And maybe once you've said this, you find they're not as bad as you thought they were.
Mr. Frank.
It seems to me that what you are all leading to is the possible events of Mr. Gowan in poetry with footnotes.
Cool.
No, we're not leading to that, Joe. Why do you say that?
Because there are so many nuances, so many degrees of self-revelation, so many inadequacies of language, so many inadequacies of knowledge of the public, that it suggests to me poetry demanding professional explanation, which should best be supplied by the poet.
Every poet turns into an Ezra Pound or a T.S. Eliot, in other words.
Perhaps,
and I'm just wondering if that might be relevant. In other words, that honesty or sincerity
perhaps can only come through
to an intelligent
public if it's
with knowledge. There's a presupposition there that, let's say, the Mr. Snodgrass who writes the poem, the Mr. Snodgrass about whom the poem is ostensibly written, are really the same person. In other words, how do we know that his expository statement of his motives is a valid example of self-analysis?
Oh, well, you don't. If it weren't, then right away you would assume that I was an insincere person, and
no
one would
care
that much less about it. Self-blinded is to me the same thing as insincere. And I'd be willing to drop the word. I don't see any reason to fight about it. Yeah, I have found out, well, and this is something else that Randall Jarrell once said to me, that as you get to writing, your voice becomes more and more, as you get to be a better writer, more and more, less, it becomes less a performance voice, less the voice of a person giving a performance, and more the voice that you use ordinarily.
This is descriptive of just one kind of poetry, really.
But I have seen this to be so in quite a number of people. I don't know that this is so in all people, no. I would expect him to talk rather heavily and portentously and dryly.
You're right.
He does.
This is the measure of
sincerity. Well, I guess so. Let me say this about Dick Gahan's poems, if I may. I read, now here, I think as he gets, in these poems, in the ones that he is most near to the Dick Gahan whom I see around the street, he becomes a better and better poet all the time. I admire the poet who wrote First Fall, but I cherish the one who wrote the last three lines of Bedtime Story. And I think that this rather quiet, I guess I would say, profound speaker is much closer to the one that I meet than is the rather performance person of First Fall, whom I admire.
But isn't it possible that since you are the official guinea pig here, that the Dick Gahan we meet on the street is not the essential Dick Gahan, that he saves his essentiality for his poetry, then we can't expect a correspondence.
No, I'll just say that sometimes, at least often, it's there. I'm not saying that it's always there. Obviously, say, Mallory was not, the Mallory that you met on the street was not the Mallory that you meet in the book.
You know, I suspect that you're substituting a moral and personal judgment for an aesthetic one here, because...